You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Okay, so we're at the halfway point of Greenbelt Festival. Can I get a woo-woo? And there's more to come. But before I introduce the next speaker, just want to let you know that you can, at any point throughout the show or after, contact a member of the wellbeing team if you're affected by the following discussion. So the next speaker is someone whose name belongs in the same sentence as resilience and courage. She's not only the first woman of colour to become Archdeacon of the Church of England. But she's also a mother who in 2020 experienced one of the most painful tragedies when both her daughters were murdered. Today, she dedicates herself to fighting for justice, not just for them, but for a better, more safer, and more equal Britain. So it's fair to say that we're all ears to what she has to say today. In conversation with award-winning author and interviewer Cole Morton, please welcome Mina Smallman.
Lovely. Am I on?
No? There we are. Hello. You're right. Just a little bit of housekeeping before we start. Amina and I have had a chat about this, and what we're going to do is divide the session up into chunks, thirds, essentially. So we'll talk for a bit, and then we'll open for 5 or 10 minutes of questions after the first chunk. And then there'll be another chunk, and the same thing will happen, and then a third chunk, and then we'll finish, rather than saving all the questions for the end. Is that okay?
Yes.
And I see you over there, all of you, and I see you all over there, and you're all very welcome, even if you're right out on the periphery with the rain on the back of your neck. I'm really sorry about that. And if you've got questions and you put your hand up, we will try and find you. Promise. Okay? And the last thing to say is, when there's questions, if you hear anything that you disagree with, can we agree to disagree with love?
Yes.
Fantastic. Okay. So, what a joy to introduce Mina Smallman. This book, A Better Tomorrow, Life Lessons in Hope and Strength, is extraordinary. It tells you things that you probably would like to know about what happened, but also beyond that, there's a resilience and a courage and a passion, and it's inspirational and it's moving. And I find it extraordinary to begin at the place that it began and to end in such an uplifting way. So for that reason, I'm really glad to have you here, Mina. Thank you. In this first part, can we start by talking about Bieber and Nicole? What were they like?
Well, they were amazing. And I'm going to start by talking about my daughter that was left behind. You know, can you imagine a parent only ever talking about how marvellous your siblings were? They were perfect, amazing, could walk on water. They were absolutely gorgeous. They were human. They could be irritating. Bieber had more attitude than Harrod's front windows, you know. She was the shortest. She was shorter than me, so she was 5 foot, and angry short woman syndrome she had from the age of about 4. So that was Bieber. And Monique, the one left behind, she is like a guru for fitness and health. She trains, she's taking up training, Pilates now. And she has been a support to us, even though she's grieving herself. Now, Nikki was the hippie. And Nikki was a member of the church. She had a really brilliant voice. We sang together in the worship team. And there is this thing that you say that families really harmonize well together. If any of you sing with siblings or whatever, you instantly, you can harmonize. You know, one goes, and the other one's, So, you know, you get it. She was a hippie. She loved festivals. She loved them so much, she managed to get herself trained in bar work so that she could go to all the festivals for free and serve in the bar. So she was canny as well. And Biba was a social worker, and she was brilliant at it. That was her thing. Nikki was a photographer and artistic and brilliant singer. And they were snuffed out at a picnic, you know, and they wouldn't actually have been there if it wasn't for COVID. And that grates on me because, as you know, number 10 were having parties and we followed the rules. They followed the rules and died following the rules. So that still grates on me. So that's them.
One of the lines in the book that really leapt out to me when you were talking about what it's like to not have them around, you said, "I don't know what to do with all the maternal love." Mm. What did you mean by that?
You know, to carry a child inside you and have them delivered, you know, as a mother who is looking forward to being a mother, there is no greater feeling or depth of love that you can have at that moment. And that moment never leaves you. And the love that you have for those children are always there, always present. And so every birthday, every big celebration, Christmas, Easter, everyone else, Mother's Day is a killer. Father's Day is a killer. You have all this love still for people who have gone. And anyone who's lost someone, even if you knew they were going to die because they had a long-term illness, bereavement and separation is cruel. But one minute to have someone there and another minute for them to be gone, and then to have the trauma that we had, we had to look for them ourselves. And it was Nikki's boyfriend, Adam, and his parents went back to the park, and Adam had to find the bodies. He will never be the same. He is scarred forever. And so that love, yeah, it can't go anywhere. You've got nothing to give it to. So in a way, what I'm doing with that maternal love is what I'm doing for everybody who has experienced losing their daughter. So now I speak to families and mothers and fathers, and we're this exclusive club that nobody would ever want to be part of. And so what I do now with that maternal love is what I'm doing now. This is my pulpit. This is talking on media and radio. That is my pulpit. And that's what I'm doing with the love.
And your husband, Chris, is there. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing that I just gave a very cool... it's very, very cool. This is a thing that's happened to you both, and you've made responses. Obviously, you've made different responses. You're different human beings. But it's something that happened to you both and that you're going through together, isn't it? And I just wanted... Because you're here, I just wanted to make that point. Mm. That must mean something to you too.
Absolutely. And... You know, statistically, lots of couples who've gone through this, they separate. And I can't, you know, I don't know why they separate. But once you've gone through this, you begin to get an insight as to why people might separate. Chris and I grieve completely differently. So he gets busy. He got on the admin, did all of that. He went out and played tennis. He did his walking football. And I do grieving mother. Don't want to talk. Don't want to engage. Don't want to do social stuff. Don't want to be seen. Don't, you know, crying and wailing and then next minute laughing hysterically, you know, completely. I do everything big. He never criticised me for the way I am now. And I never criticised him. I never said to him, how can you play football? Who cares about, why are you going out to play tennis? Why are you acting like nothing's happened? I could imagine that that could be part of the reason why people don't survive. We were friends before we were a couple, and our caring is deep and long. And I don't judge him and he doesn't judge me. That's where we're at. And he's amazing, by the way. I do all the razzle-dazzle, you know. You know, I do all the tap dancing, arms waving and all the rest of it. He just sits there like, oh, well. But but he is my rock.
Mm.
He knows the real me.
Yeah.
And he doesn't buy into this, you know, tap dancing, all of that stuff. He knows after that I'll be shattered and he will take care of me.
Oh, bless him.
So well done, Chris.
Yeah. All right. The book is tells in some detail what happened, and including the really very difficult moments. But one thing I just want to put a pin in.
Mm.
You just said we had to go and find their bodies.
Mm.
Let's name why you had to do that.
Yeah, you know, the Met didn't follow missing persons procedures. They knew right from the beginning, the first person who made a call. And if you don't know the story, if I say so myself, there's a couple of really good documentaries out there about our story. The first one I did with Stacey Dooley and its two daughters. And in case anyone's thinking, you know, white saviour issue, I asked her and I told her, I'm asking you because I'm using you. Because people love you. And so that's why I'm asking you. And you know what? She's even nicer in person. We're friends. She's no bullshitter. She is the real deal. So there's that one. And then the second one, which shows you in detail where things went wrong, is a three-parter. It was BAFTA nominated. I'm pleased by that. Woo-hoo! It's a three-parter and it shows you in detail. There wasn't one phone call. There were like 16 different phone calls phoning the police and asking them, where are you? Where are you? Why aren't you looking? And to add insult to injury, when the bodies were found, because it was so late in the day, they protected the area with a tent because they wanted to preserve as much of the, you know, the crime scene as they could, which had been, could have been completely whitewashed because there was rain like today, or the last couple of days happened after they were murdered. And then if you don't know our story, what you will remember is the police officers who were supposed to be protecting the crime scene thought it would be a really good idea if they go in and take photographs of the dead bodies and send them to a WhatsApp group. 44 members on that WhatsApp group. And the name of the WhatsApp group, I'm not sure if they're children, was COVID. That was the name of the group. So, you know, talk about rubbing salt in the wound. At every level of indignity that could have happened to our daughters pretty much did.
It's usual form to say when a word is like that is used. We apologise for the obscenity, but actually, there's a bigger obscenity here, right? Something. So, you know, if you are offended by that word, sorry, but there is a really big obscenity here. How, I mean, it's an obvious question. How do you cope with that in relation to those two individuals who you call in the book Despicable One and Despicable Two?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that in relation to them?
Well, it's interesting. I've forgiven the murderer, but I haven't forgiven the two police officers. And I've asked myself that question. You know, I forgive that man or boy, man boy, because of God's grace. That I don't have an explanation for that, because I am your archetypal ferocious mother who would rip your head off if I was in the same room with you, if you were going to hurt my kids. And as a priest, I remember there was a black mother whose son was killed at a bus stop because he was with his girlfriend was white. And that week, she was interviewed outside the court, and she was asked, "Have you forgiven the killers?" And her words were, "I must, because that's what Christians do. I have." And I preached that Sunday. I said, I am not sure I would be able to do the same. Christianity is not easy. To be a real Christian, to live out your life, not just be a Sunday Christian, to be an everyday Christian is not easy. And when people say, you know, it's a crutch, really?
It's a painful crutch. Yeah.
You know, it's like every day, if you're a real Christian, you look in the mirror. I would say, jokingly, I like to laugh. I like to make people laugh. I would say, I am a priest, but actually, the more I get to understand what it is to be a true Christian, I'm not even sure I'm getting into heaven. And I think that's a healthy way to view it. Because if you think you're there already, you're not. We are a continuous project of hard work. You know, you go one step forward, four steps back, because life is challenging. And so my faith washed over me. You know, at the time when you're thinking, I have nothing. I have nothing left to give. That is the point where you feel the Holy Spirit. It just grabs you and holds you. And I can testify to that, because humanly, and you'll read in the book, I suffer with mental health. I have had suicide attempts. You know, I'm human. And so this shouldn't make you laugh, but I hope it does. Third time I attempted, and I don't play, you know, I do everything properly. You know, the first time I woke up in intensive care, you know, twice in intensive care. The third time I woke up and I thought to myself, what's going on? What is going on? I genuinely, you know, in my head, and people who have suicide attempts, they think it's like a really glum moment, but at some point it feels like this is, I want to go away. I actually want to go to where my girls are. I want to go. And I woke up and I did. I think the psych came to me and said, you know, how do you feel? I said, I'm pissed off. did you? Why? I said, because I'm still here. And I said, but I've got it now. I've got it. He, she, they are not going to let me go until I've done what I was put on this earth to do. And so, no more attempts. You know, I don't like being a loser. And so I've got the message. I've got the message. I have to deal with the pain. I have to deal with it and do what I've been put on this earth to do. So, go figure.
Yeah. You want any more content like that? Get the book. Thank you for sharing that. And I do obviously just want to say that members of the wellbeing team are around. So if you want to talk to somebody, there are people around who will talk to you. There are hands up over there. I don't know why the hands are up over there. Are they for questions? Oh, they're the wellbeing team. There they are. Hey. They're either the wellbeing team or a very badly dressed ABBA tribute. I can't tell which. Okay. We're going to go to some questions at this point. Let's start over there because I can see a microphone. Can we see any questions over there? No? Really?
Yeah, we've got one.
Oh, we've got one. Great. Thank you. And we're coming over here next. And then we'll come here.
Yeah, I remember. Thank you for sharing what you've shared so far. I just wondered, obviously, whilst you're still going through that grieving process and dealing with that, but still have a daughter to raise, how she was through that time of difficulty and how she is now?
Mm. That's a really good question to ask. She did brave face for us for a lot. And, you know, we've never managed to do a Christmas at home except during COVID because we, you know, December was, we were still in restrictions. And so she would come to every Christmas, every New Year, and 2 years ago, I said to her, Monique, you're not coming to us this Christmas. You're going somewhere else because you need to be taken care of. You need time to get your head right. And she always said she wanted to go to Australia and Thailand and all that. And I said, we're going to fund for you to go and do you. You know, eat, pray, love moment. You know, go away and do your thing. So she went to elephant sanctuaries and, you know, she's very spiritual. And so she, yeah, elephants are spiritual, listen. You just don't know. and so she went off and did that. But interestingly, she concealed it and she started getting physical pain. So she suddenly got this terrible pain in her neck and she needed to get support for that. And these things, she never had any of that because her whole thing is this physical fitness and all of that. And then last year, she lost her voice. She just couldn't speak. It was like her whisper was like, and that, all of that was a manifestation of denial, of not dealing with the pain. And she's having help now, and she now realizes that she needs to take care of her, and we will take care of ourselves and her. And that's the truth of it. You know, often we push through grief and we don't look it in the eye, and that's when deep-seated problems start to happen. So thank you for that.
Okay, do we have a question over this side? I can't see where the microphone is. Oh, there's the microphone. Is there a question? Can we see one?
Yes.
I think, oh yes, there's some action going on. Here we are.
I've got some friends who have actually lost children, but through different circumstances than yourself. Mm. And one of them, when she does communicate with me, always says, I just feel so terribly sad and just cry all the time. And I just wondered, what would be your suggestions on the good way friends can support somebody in that sort of situation? Mm-hmm. I don't want to overburden her by having too much in, but want to do something to support.
That's really good. I often won't answer my phone. I don't want to talk to anybody. And I've become quite introverted. And so, but friends know because I've told them, you sending me a text of warmth, of generosity, I receive them, even though I don't tell you or I may not respond at that particular time. You know, little gestures go a long, long way, because trying to talk about it can re-traumatise you. And so encourage them to speak to somebody professional, you know, and say, you know, let's do something. Or even say to someone, look, let's go somewhere together, you know, like, I don't know, a park or something, do something, a coffee. And you know what? Even if you don't want to talk, we don't have to talk. I just want you to know you're not alone. And it doesn't matter what time you want to call me. You know, any o'clock will do me. I'm here. And I just find texts, and you know, text prayers and blessings. You know, even if the person doesn't believe yet, just send it, because people will receive that love. A card, a plant, even a plant on the left on the doorstep. You know, like, I came round and I left something on the doorstep for you. That really means a lot. And you know, you might give them the courage to think, all right, I will give them a call. Hope that helps.
Mm. We're going to come to questions in the middle, in the next tranche, if that's... Oh, we've got one here. Let's go very quickly to this one. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a survivor, and the damage caused meant I could never have children. And so when you were describing Mother's Day and all that, I've always thought it's far worse for someone like you to have had and lost than for someone like me. As painful as it is and as horrendous as it is, at least I never gave birth to that child and lost it. I just lost the ability. And a lot of people say to me, well, how can you believe in God when you've had that? Because it started when I was very young. And I said, I believe in God because of that, because he was with me in the womb. Jeremiah is my favourite. He's with me in the womb, and he's always been with me. And friend, people who don't believe just don't understand. And I just wonder, in your position as well, have you had that sort of, you know, how can you trust God? How can you say, and that sort of thing? Because it's really painful when people say it.
I mean, Chris, he actually said to me, you know, how could God let something like this happen to someone like you? And my answer is, and it's not glib, God didn't make this happen. Yeah? The killer was driven by another beat. He actually, this is the irony of it, he killed our daughters because he had signed a pact with a demon to, wait for it, to be completely sexually attractive to any female he wanted, and that he would win the Euro Millions. And his payment to the demon was to kill 6 women every 6 months. Oh, and by the way, the police weren't supposed to find him either. That was it. Now, how, you know, it's sort of talk about, if I could, if I wanted to, I could spin it and say, well, where were you when he was doing the plotting? Why my kids? Well, you know, if I thought like that, back to the question of what is a true Christian? Does anybody deserve that? No one. You know, I don't say, why was it my child? I don't just fight for women of colour. I say, I want to model what it is to be a decent human being. I campaign for all women and girls. I don't care what your colour is, what your faith is, what, because everybody matters. And incidentally, if you're a woman and you like children, some people just don't like children. I mean, I've met lots of teachers who don't like children. Do you know what I mean? You know, if you have to actually like children. So you probably have been a mother figure or sister figure or, you know, to so many people. And, you know, on Mother's Day, I think loads of women are a mothering influence to children. And, you know, some of us didn't have great mums. Some of us didn't have great dads. So Mother's Day and Father's Day isn't always a joy for people. One of the things I've come to say to myself and to other mothers, I'm fortunate that I had my two daughters for the length of time I had them. And I think of the parents who lose their children either through miscarriage or at birth, cot death, you know, or they're 5 or 6. You know, I try and find the joy that I had Bieber for nearly 50 years and Nikki was 27. And so I had that time with them that I can call on when I want to. So thank you for your question.
Can we just go back to the forgiveness question? Because it's a huge one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And simply and directly, let me just ask you. You said that you had forgiven the killer.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do that? What's the process? What took you there?
There was no process. There was no process. I can tell you, he behaved so badly in the court, I just wanted to batter him senseless, really. But so I had nothing but contempt for him. And I hadn't even had a conversation with myself or prayed about it and, you know, please help me forgive this person. Never happened. And I was having, after the court case, I was being interviewed by Michelle Hussein from the BBC. And she asked me the question, and it's in the documentary. She asked me, have you forgiven the killer? And there was a moment, because I don't know if you've ever really had a bad feeling about someone and you really can't stand them. It lives somewhere in your body. You know it's in there, don't you? You just kind of, they mention their name and you think, ugh, you know. And she said, she asked me that question. And I did that internal scan that you do. And I was able to say to her, I already have. Chris was in the room. His head nearly flew off. He said, you know. And he asked me, he said, you've forgiven him. I said, yeah, it's gone. Nothing there. That was God's grace. Because I'm telling you, if I hadn't forgiven him, all my energy would have been hoping that somebody did him a damage in prison. You know, all my thoughts would have been about the 100 different ways I want him to suffer. That's how I knew it was God's grace. And I thank him for it because I would have become a prisoner. And so I don't have, you know, a suggestion. You know, if somebody's holding something here, all I can advise and say to you, look, pray about it and pray for that grace, because it's you that are held captive. You who dread meeting that person, dread seeing that person, dread being in that room with that person. If you can let that go, just pray for grace. That's all I can say. And, you know, Despicable 1 and 2, I've had chats with myself about that. You know, I have worked out that there is a hierarchy. The person I shouldn't forgive is the killer, and the Despicables, perhaps. So I've had this conversation with myself and God, and I've come to understand that I can't forgive that, because that is the fire in my belly to reform police. That's it. I have to keep on. It's the reminder. I don't think about them and I don't care about them, but I can't say, because they knew better. They signed up. Their pledge, their oath is to protect and serve. And they did neither. So I reckon that's what that's about. Mm.
And I want to come on to the campaigning element and what happened to you afterwards. Just as a bridge into that, though, I want to ask you this question. There's a moment in the book where you say something like, and forgive me for paraphrasing, it was as if my life up to this point had been preparation for the worst thing that could happen to me.
Yeah.
And I think that was a reference to your faith, to your experience, to your public position as an archdeacon, all of that. But what did you mean by that?
People often say to me or ask me, how do you remain so calm and balanced when you're being interviewed and, you know, measured? Like, I don't demonise all police, because they're not all bad. And they said, you know, you seem so eloquent. And I said, look, I already had the toolkit. So I was fostered until I was 5. I was brought up in a mixed race family. I faced racism. I faced poverty. I faced discrimination. I trained in drama. So being able to do this comes naturally. I trained kids to be able to, you know, kids who were introverted, I taught them how to fake it till they make it. You know, when the parents' evening, a kid that was an A-star student, their parents were saying, he wants to do drama. Why does he want to do drama? I said, because your son is an introvert and he needs to learn that he won't be the only one who goes for an interview, and people will outshine him, but I will teach him how to present himself in the best way. I was teaching all boys then, by the way. And so, you know, and being a priest, teaching, I said, this is my pulpit. I do the same thing I used to do before I went to preach. I would say, can you please tell me what you want me to impart to these people today? So I would hand it over. And that's, I still do that now. Before I do an interview, before I did this, I say, what is it that you want me to tell these people today? I never rehearse. I insist on never knowing what I'm going to be asked. And I always say, nothing is ever off the table. Because I think if people are responding to me and my message, it is because you can tell I'm being me. I'm being genuine. I haven't got an angle. I don't want to be famous. I just want to get, I want the world to be a better place. And I want, now, honestly, I spiraled. Normally, I'm like like that when I'm talking to people in authority. So I've got people on my phone that I've got that you'd think, bloody hell, you know, and I phone them and they answer. And so but I'm always measured. I never phone just because I can. You know, I see something on the telly. So Mark Rowley, for example, he gets it. But I tell him off often. And he takes it. And I spiraled recently. Any of you aware of the Levy case? The guy who just got... he got put away for a long, long time. This guy was a predator. He used the trains. He would take his victims. And he went into prison for sexually assaulting women. He sexually assaulted a female prison officer and they let him out. How does that happen? He didn't turn up for court appearances and no one arrested him. And it wasn't until he killed two women, one of whom had four children. And so Sir Mark comes outside and says, I'm ever so sorry. I phoned him. I said, this is getting ridiculous. How many times are you going to come out and say sorry? Do you think that sorry meant anything to those four kids or the parents? Get a grip of what... And then I phoned everybody... And I lost it. I totally lost it. And I said, that's it. I'm not measured anymore. I'm sick of your words. I want action. And I don't want this early release. You do not let anyone out who has hurt women, children. No, not happening. And I said, and do not think that the public are fooled. This is for Andy Burnham. And I've said, I want to see you. And I've been told he's going to see you. All the MPs I knew have written him, you need to see her. And so I said, do not play with us. Don't you dare keep those two, you know, the people who killed the policeman. They shouldn't come out. No way. But do not dare to use that as a lever so that we think, oh, well, they did listen to us about that. No. Do not play with us, because do not let men out that have hurt women. No. And so they put up with me. They actually, I think if you don't do that often, they get it when you're genuine, because I spiraled. I went from an activist to a grieving mum. I was furious, really angry, incensed. So let's watch this space.
Let's have a couple of questions from here. There's one down here. Person in a white jumper and a fisherman's cap.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I do live by the coast in Devon. But my question was, when you do spiral, is there a verse or a time you go back to where you rediscover a still God who is with you?
No. No. No, I'm nothing if not real. No, that because I don't do it often, and because I have no control over it whatsoever, I think possibly the Holy Spirit has decided, let it go. Yeah, you need enough with the measured, you know, articulate, still waters nonsense. Just let it all out. And so, no. In those moments, I am not Well, I don't go near people for a start, so I'm a good Christian because I'm not out there. But but no, no. But I'm one of the fortunate ones. I have actually felt the presence of the Holy Spirit. One of my ministries was spiritual healing. So I was one of those that went, it's in the book, I was one of those who went round houses where people thought that they had nasty things in there. Most of the time they didn't. They'd just been watching films that made them think they had nasty things in there. But actually, a couple I've gone to that did have nasty things in there. And I had my own personal experience as a teenager in the book. The book's really good, by the way. I'm just thinking, but it's also funny because I, you know, Chris and I, we look for any opportunity to laugh. You know, people often walk around us like they're on eggshells and we want to make people comfortable. You know, who wants to have a conversation before they go on holiday? Chris and I, we went on holiday and we had this conversation. You know, when you meet new people, they say, oh, have you got children? And you say, yes. Oh, how many have you got? And we decided we were never going to deny that we had 3 children. So how are we going to phrase it? So I said to Chris, well, I did have 3, now I've got 1. Oh, what happened? They were murdered. Chris said, no, that's too blunt. He said, that's too blunt. And I said, well, what are you going to say then? So I personally, I've only had that a couple of times, but I know when Chris is, you know, because he does all the table tennis and gets to know people and they, oh, hi, Chris, whatever. And I will see these people and I know he's had that conversation because they normally they go, hi. And then when I see him and they go. And I smile and I go, I said, you told them, didn't they? He said, yeah, I had to because they asked the question. And I said, you know, so we get a lot of that. You know.
That's a great answer to that question. Thank you. Okay. Do we have one more? We have one over there, I think. Can we get a microphone there? Is that all right? I think we had one down here. Did I miss one? Yeah, we'll come to you next.
Can I ask a bit more about what happened with the police investigation? Particularly about what may or may not have happened to Despicable One and Despicable Two, but also the lack of searching and maybe the aspect of race in that. What does justice look like for you?
You know, I chuckle to myself. You know, when they talk about two-tier policing, and it's interesting, the two-tier policing only matters when it's white. So that poor boy who was stabbed and the Asian guy said he had racially abused, that was wrong. That was wrong on so many levels. But the outcry with this two-tier, policing, listen, two-tier policing has gone on for a very long time. You know, when I'm invited to speak at different constabulary, so police forces all over the country invite me to come and speak to them about my experience and what they could do better. One of the things I say to them after they've told me a bit about what they want me to do, I ask them, what's the morale like? And I always get the same answer and they say, oh, it's dreadful. It's really bad. People just don't have any faith in us. They see the uniform and they walk away. And I said, do you know what? That isn't a bad thing because now you know how a black youth feels. In the same way that not everyone who wears a police uniform is corrupt, that applies to black youths. Not every black youth you see is a criminal. And so the West Indians have a saying, if you can't hear, you have to feel. So I try every opportunity I can to get people to understand what it's like from another person's perspective. And that lack of faith, I could have just gone, yeah, good for you, glad you're suffering. But what I do is I try and get them, you know how that feels, well, tell your colleagues, do better. And the Despicables, they went to prison. They got a prison sentence. And there's been a lot of work done to get rid of WhatsApps. But you know what? It's never going to happen. Because bad people will always graduate to professions that give them instant access and trust. Same with dog collars. You know, school teachers, scout leaders, they will always. So you can never entirely get rid of it. You just have to be vigilant all the time. And so I hope that answers your question.
I think it's also worth pointing out, you're very good in the book at, on the one hand, calling out directly and forcefully the things that were very, very bad, but also recognising that there were individuals within that who were caring, you know, family liaison people who were human. There was a human-to-human connection.
Yeah, and I did I do it deliberately? No. I said to Chris that when that came out about the Despicables, I said to Chris, the good people will overcompensate now to try and cancel out the bad. I'm sure they were always going to do a good job. But, you know, you're people of faith, right? So you know that there are no coincidences with God, right? You know that. If you don't know that, you need to go back to your Bible. But the very day, I did 3 days working with the Metropolitan Police, and it was always decided, myself talking to Sir Mark, that I would be talking, I would end the 3 days talking to the great and the good of the Metropolitan Police. And I asked for a list of who was going to be there. I looked at that list and I thought, oh my goodness, they were all there. So counter-terrorism, even these are all the top brass of all of the different departments, even the armed forces and the people who look after the royals, they were all there. And so the night before, I'd arranged to talk to Sir Mark, and I said to him, we're having this conversation, he said, Mina, can I just ask you, are you there for the whole of the meeting? You know, are you there maybe just in the morning? Or I said, no, I'm there. I always insist on being at a whole training thing because I want to know what it is you talk about and how you get to where you're going. He said, oh, okay, I've got something to tell you. I said, oh, yeah. He said, it's going to come out and we're going to have to announce it to the leadership team. Panorama did, you know, a secret thing in Charing Cross, and it's coming on the telly this week. And I thought, I know why you asked me. I said, I know why you asked me now. You were hoping I wasn't going to be there for that bit, didn't you? He said, yeah. So I said, I knew that wasn't a coincidence, because when I spoke to them, because they did that bit before, and you know, when he was saying it, heads went down, heads were like, oh God, not another one. No. And then it was me to talk to them. And I said, do you know what? I'm glad I was here for that. I said, because the law of averages, some people in this room who knew I was coming to talk to you was saying to themselves, oh, here we go. Angry black woman going to tell us all off. Well, we've sorted it now and we know what we're doing and the blah, blah, blah. I said, so that was from up there to you to say, don't stop looking. Sometimes you need to catch people when they don't know they're being watched. So if ever you needed to know that this will never stop and you have to stay on it 24/7, this is a call. This is your call. And so I was really pleased about that.
We had a question here. This will be a... Yeah,
I'm humbled by your capacity to forgive, and I'm not sure I would, but I understand the release you've had from that. But I wonder if I may ask, have you had any desire to meet the person you have forgiven? And is he aware that you have forgiven him? And what's resulted from that, if anything?
Yeah, they call it restorative justice. And I started the process to do that with the Despicables. And I think there was no restoring it. I just wanted a chance to say to them, how have you changed? You know, so it wouldn't have been true. But no, I have no desire to meet with him whatsoever. One of the prayers I have for all the women and girls who have been killed is that up until recently, the focus was always on the killer, his life, their story, how they ended up. And whether you like it or not, it kind of gives them kudos, you know, like I'm the important one. And his name is never mentioned. When I'm being interviewed, no one ever says his name. I've never seen it anywhere except when the court case was going on. And it's like he's been wiped off the earth. And so he doesn't exist in my eyes. And to go and see him, and to be honest, when I saw him and how he was behaving, that young man has no capacity or had no capacity to see anything else except himself and what he wanted. And so, you know, I wouldn't give him the time of day. Maybe that makes me shallow, I don't know, but he doesn't exist for me. So I've got no desire to meet with him whatsoever. And I hope he does find God, and I hope he does heal, and I hope he is becoming a better person. But no, thank you though.
So Mina asked me to say that after this, we're going to go straight over to the bookstore. Is it just there? Yeah, where she's going to do a signing, and would be happy to talk to people. But we're not going to linger in here because we need to get over there. And so that's not a personal thing. If you're hoping to do that, she's more than welcome to see people over there. That's right, isn't it? So we're going to do that. But I just wanted to finish by just giving you the opportunity to say whatever it is that you want to say about where we are now and what we need to move people to do from this position. Because we've heard from you, and you've been beautiful and open and vulnerable with us. And there's so much empathy and compassion in this room, but there's also the question, so what? What do we do now? Mm. So what do you say to
them? Yeah. Everybody I talk to, I call us a movement. And you know about movements, don't you? And you know about community. And you have your own vineyard, don't you? You have your own circle of friends, your workplace, your schools, your colleges. I say, if you are in a room where someone is speaking hate and you don't say something, you're part of the problem. Because, and I know it's not easy, because I was the one who would do that. Even before this, I was the one who would say, look, I don't agree with what you're saying, and it's not right that you're saying it as if it is the norm. It's uncomfortable. But complacency is one of the biggest evils in the world at the moment, because you end up colluding even though you don't know you are. Be that voice that speaks truth with kindness, but with authority. And please don't say, "Oh, and I'm a Christian." Don't say that, because they'll just shut everything up. You know, they'll think, "Oh God, here we go." Don't use the "I am a Christian." It's great that you're a Christian, but if you want people who are not Christians to hear you, speak the love of Christ so they can hear it and receive it. That's the thing that you need to do. Do not be a participant in something that you would never really want to be. But your silence is dangerous. And our young men are being radicalized on social media. If you have youngsters or young people in your life, get interested on what they are looking at on their computers or their phones. It is horrendous. You know, the thought that a young person can research how to be bulimic, how to be anorexic, how to kill themselves, the horrendous things are out there. So be vigilant, be loving, be an active person in your community where you work, and make things better wherever you go. Please.
Mina Smallman.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts. For free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.